as I tell lies. He avoided the main entrance and headed as circumspectly as possible for Wizard's Passage, where, halfway down, university access for all was available via several loose bricks. Generations of rascally drunk student wizards had used them to get back in late at night. Later on, they'd become very important and powerful wizards, with full beards and fuller stomachs, but had never lifted a finger to have the wall repaired. It was, after all, traditional. Nor was it usually patrolled by the lobsters. The university porters, or bledlows, who doubled with rather more enthusiasm as its under-proctors, a private police force. They commanded their nickname for being thick-shelled, liable to turn red when hot, and having the smallest brain for their size of any known creature. They believed in tradition even more than the wizards. On this occasion, though, one was lurking in the shadows and jumped when Vimes tapped him on the shoulder. "Oh, it's you, Commander Vimes, sir. It's me, sir, Wiggly, sir. The Arch-Chancellor is waiting for you in the gardener's hut, sir. Follow me, sir. Mum's the word, eh, sir?" Vimes trailed after Wiggly across the dark, squelchy lawns. Oddly, though, he didn't feel so tired now. Days and days of bad sleep, and he felt quite fresh in a fuzzy sort of way. It was the smell of the chase, that's what it was. He'd pay for it later. Wiggly, looking both ways with a conspiratorial air that would have attracted instant attention had anyone been watching, opened the door of the garden shed. There was a large figure waiting inside. "Commander!" it bellowed happily. "What larks, eh? Very cloak and dagger!" Only heavy rain could possibly muffle the voice of Arch-Chancellor Ridcully when he was feeling cheerful. "Could you keep it down a bit, Arch-Chancellor?" said Vimes, shutting the door quickly. "Sorry! I mean sorry!" said the wizard. "Do take a seat! The compost sacks are quite acceptable. Well, how may I help you, Sam?"
"Can we agree for now that you can't?" said Vimes.
"Intriguing! Do continue!" said Ridcully, leaning closer.
"You know I won't have magic used in the watch," Vimes went on. As he sat down in the semi-darkness, a coiled-up hosepipe ambushed him from above, as they do, and he had to wrestle it to the shed floor.
"I do, sir, and I respect you for it, although there are those that think you're a damn silly fool."
"Well," Vimes said, trying to put damn silly fool behind him, "the fact is, I must get to Coombe Valley very fast. Very fast indeed."
"Well, I might say magically fast," said Ridcully.
"As it were," said Vimes, fidgeting. He really hated having to do this. And what had he sat on?
"Hmm," said Ridcully. "But without, I imagine, any significant hocus-pocus? You appear uncomfortable, sir."
Vimes triumphantly held up a large onion.
"Sorry,"
he said, tossing it aside. "No, definitely no pocus. Possibly a little hocus. I just need an edge. They got a day's start on me."
"I see. You'll be travelling alone?"
"No, there will have to be 11 of us. 2 coaches."
"My word. And disappearing in a puff of smoke to reappear elsewhere is,
"Out of the question. I just need
an edge," said the wizard. "Yes. Something magical in its cause, but not in its effect. Nothing too obvious."
"And no chance of anyone being turned into a frog or anything like that," said Vimes quickly.
"Of course," said Ridcully.
He clapped his hands together.
"Well, Commander, I'm afraid we can't help you. Meddling in things like this is not what wizarding is all about." He lowered his voice and went on. "We'll particularly not be able to help you if you have the coaches empty around the back in, oh, call it about an hour?"
"Oh, I have right," said Vimes, trying to catch up. "You're not going to make them fly or anything, are you?"
"We're not going to do anything, Commander," said Ridcully jovially, slapping him on the back. "I thought that was agreed. And I think also you should leave now, although, of course, you have, in fact, not been here. And neither have I. I say, this spying business is pretty clever, eh?"
When Vimes was gone, Mustrum Ridcully sat back, lit his pipe, and, as an afterthought, used the last of the match to light the candle lantern on the potting table. The gardener could get pretty acerbic if people messed about with his shed, so perhaps he ought to tidy up a bit. He stared at the floor, where a tumbled hosepipe and a fallen onion made what looked at a casual glance like a large eyeball with a tail. The rain cooled Vimes down. It had cooled down the streets, too. You have to be really keen to riot in the rain. Besides, news of last night had got around. No one was sure, of course, and such were the effects of Fluff and Big Hammer that a large, if elementary, school of thought had been left uncertain about what really happened. They woke up feeling bad, right? Something must have happened. And tonight the rain was setting in, so maybe it was better to stay in the pub. He walked through the wet, whispering darkness, mind ablaze. How fast could those dwarfs travel? Some of them sounded pretty old, but they'd be tough and old. Even so, the roads in that direction were none too good, and a body could only stand so much shaking. And Sybil was taking young Sam. That was stupid. Except that it wasn't stupid, not after dwarfs had broken into your home. Home was where you had to feel safe. If you didn't feel safe, it wasn't home. Against all common sense, he agreed with Sybil. Home was where they were together. She'd already sent off an urgent clax to some old chum of hers, who lived near the valley. She seemed to think it was going to be some kind of family outing. There was a group of dwarfs hanging around on a corner, heavily armed. Maybe the bars were all full. Or maybe they needed cooling down too. No law against hanging around, right? Wrong, growled Vimes as he drew nearer. Come along, boys. Say something wrong. Lay hold of a weapon. Move slightly. Breathe loudly. Give me something that could be stretched to in self-defence. It'd be my word against yours, and believe me, lads, I'm unlikely to leave you capable of saying a single damn thing. The dwarfs took one clear look at the approaching vision, haloed in torchlight and mist, and took to their heels. Right. The entity known as the Summoning Dark sped through streets of eternal night, past misty buildings of memory that wavered at its passage. It was getting there. It was getting there. It was having to change the habits of millennia, but it was finding ways in, even if they were no bigger than keyholes. It had never had to work this hard before, never had to move this fast. It was exhilarating. But always, when it paused by some grating or unguarded chimney, it heard the pursuit. It was slow, but it never stopped following. Sooner or later, it would catch up. Greg Bashfulson lodged in a subdivided cellar in Cheap Street. The rent wasn't much, but he had to admit that neither was the accommodation. He could lie on his very narrow bed and touch all four walls, or, rather, three walls and a heavy curtain that separated his little space from that of the family of 19 dwarfs that occupied the rest of the cellar. But meals were included, and they respected his privacy. It was something to have a Greg as a lodger, even if this one seemed rather young and showed his face. It was still something to impress the neighbours with. On the other side of the curtain, children were squabbling, a baby was crying, and there was the smell of rat and cabbage casserole. Someone was sharpening an axe, and someone else was snoring. For a dwarf in Ankh-Morpork, solitude was something that you had to cultivate on the inside. Books and papers filled the space that wasn't bed. Bashfulson's desk was a board laid across his knees. He was reading a battered book, its cover cracked and mouldy, and the runes passing under his eye said, "It has no strength in this world. To fulfil any purpose, the dark must find a champion, a living creature it can bend to its will." Bashfulson sighed. He'd read the phrase a dozen times, hoping he could make it mean something other than the obvious. He copied the words into his notebook anyway. Then he put the notebook in his satchel, swung the satchel onto his back, went and paid Toyin Footstamper 2 weeks' rent in advance, and stepped out into the rain. Vimes didn't remember going to sleep. He didn't remember sleeping. He surfaced from darkness when Carrot shook him awake. "The coaches are in the yard, Mr. Vimes." "Whiz up," murmured Vimes, blinking in the light. "I've told people to load them up, sir, but..." "But what?" Vimes sat up. "I think you'd better come and see, sir." When Vimes stepped out into the damp dawn, two coaches were indeed standing in the yard. Detritus was idly watching the loading while leaning on the peacemaker. Carrot hurried over when he saw the commander. "It's the wizard, sir," he said. "They've done something." The coaches looked normal enough to Vimes, and he said so. "Oh, they look fine," said Carrot. He reached down and put his hand on the door sill and added, "But they do this." He lifted the laden coach over his head. "You shouldn't be able to do that," said Vimes. "That's right, sir," said Carrot, lowering the coach gently onto the cobbles. "It doesn't get any heavier with people inside, either. And if you come over here, sir, they've done something to the horses, too." "Any idea what they've done, Captain?" "None whatsoever, sir. The coaches were just outside the university. Haddock and I drove them down here. Very light, of course. It's the harnesses that are worrying me. See here, sir." "I see the leather's very thick," said Vimes. "And what are all those copper knobs? Something magical?" "Could be, sir. Something happens at 13 miles an hour. I don't know what." Carrot patted the side of the coach, which slid away. "The thing is, sir, I don't know how much of an edge this gives you." "What? Surely a weightless coach would—" "Oh, it'll help, sir, especially on the inclines. But horses can only go so fast for so long, sir, and once they've got the coach moving, it's a rolling weight and not so much of a problem.
13 miles an hour, Fimes mused.
That's pretty fast. Well, the mail coaches are getting 9 or 10 miles an hour average on many runs now, said Carrot, but the roads will get a lot worse when you get near Coombe Valley.
You don't think it'll take wing, do you?
I think the wizards would have said so if it was going to do something like that, sir. But it's funny you should mention it, because there's 7 broomsticks nailed underneath each coach.
What?
Why don't they just float out of the yard?
Magic, sir. I think they just compensate for the weight.
Good grief, yes. Why didn't I think of that? Said Fimes sourly.
And that's why I don't like magic, Captain, because it's magic. You can't ask questions. It's magic. It doesn't explain anything. It's magic. You don't know where it comes from. It's magic. That's what I don't like about magic. It does everything by magic.
That's the significant factor, sir. There's no doubt about it, said Carrot.
I'll just see to the last of the packing, if you'll excuse me.
Vimes glared at the coaches. He probably shouldn't have brought in the wizards, but where was the choice? Oh, they could probably have sent Sam Vimes all that way in a puff of smoke and the blink of an eye, but who'd actually arrived there and who'd come back? How would he know if it was him? He was certain that people were not supposed to disappear like that. Sam Vimes had always been, by nature, a pedestrian. That's why he was also going to take Willikins, who knew how to drive. He'd also demonstrated to Vimes his ability to throw a common fish knife so hard that it was quite difficult to pull it out of the wall. At times like this, Vimes liked to see a skill like that in a butler.
"Excuse me, sir," said Detritus behind him. "Could I have a word personal?"
"Yeah, of course," said Vimes.
I hope what I said yesterday in the cells wasn't going to—"
"Can't remember a word of it," said Vimes. Detritus looked relieved.
"Thank you, sir. I want to take young Brick with us, sir. He's got no kin here, doesn't even know what clan he is. He'll only get messed up again if I take my eye off of him. And he's never seen the mountains, never been outside the city, even."
There was a pleading look in the troll's eyes. Vimes recollected that his marriage to Ruby was happy but childless.
"Well, we don't seem to have a weight problem," he said. "All right. But you're to keep an eye on him, okay?"
The troll beamed.
"Yes, sir. I'll see you don't regret it, sir."
"Breakfast, Sam," called Sybil from the doorway.
Horrible suspicion gripped Vimes, and he hurried over to the other coach where Carrot was strapping on the last bag.
"Who packed the food? Did Sybil pack the food?" he said.
"I think so, sir."
"Was there
fruit?" said Vimes, probing the horror.
"I believe so, sir. Quite a lot. And vegetables."
"Some bacon, surely," Vimes was nearly begging.
"Very good for a long journey, bacon. It travels well."
"I think it's staying at home today," said Carrot. "I have to tell you, sir, that Lady Sybil has found out about the bacon sandwich arrangement. She said to tell you the game was up, sir."
"I am the commander around here, you know," said Vimes,
with as much as from the dripping forests colonizing the scree that had built up against the walls. They gurgled into holes and rose again miles away as fountains. They had no mappable course. A good storm higher up in the mountains could bring house-sized rocks and half a stricken woodland down in the flood, blocking the sinkholes and piling up dams. Some of these could survive for years, becoming little islands in the leaping waters, growing little forests and little meadows and colonies of big birds. Then some key rock would be shifted by a random river, and within an hour it would all be gone. Nothing that couldn't fly lived in the valley, at least for long. The dwarfs had tried to tame it back before the first battle. It hadn't worked. Hundreds of trolls and dwarfs had been swept up in the famous flood, and many had never been found again. Coombe Valley had taken them all into its sinkholes and chambers and caverns, and had kept them. There were places in the valley where a man could drop a coloured cork into a swirling sinkhole and wait for more than 20 minutes before it bobbed up on a fountain less than a dozen yards away. Eric himself had seen this trick done by a guide, Vimes read, who'd demanded $0.50 for the demonstration. Oh yes, people visited the valley, human sightseers, poets, and artists looking for inspiration in the ragged, uncompromising wildness. And there were human guides who'd take them up there, for a hefty price. For a few extra dollars, they'd tell the history of the place. They'd tell you how the wind in the rocks and the roaring of the waters carried the sounds of ancient battle continuing in death. They'd say, maybe all those trolls and dwarfs the valley took are still fighting, down there in the dark maze of caves and thundering torrents. One admitted to Eric that when he was a boy, during a cool summer when the melt waters were pretty low, he'd roped down into one of the sinkholes, because, like all such stories, the history of Coombe Valley wouldn't have been complete without rumours of vast treasures swept down into the dark, and had himself heard, above the sound of the water, battle noises and the shouting of dwarfs. "No, sir, honestly, sir, it chilled my blood, so it did, sir. Why, thank you, sir, very much, sir." Vimes sat up in his seat. Was that true? If that man had gone a little further, would he have found the little talking cube that Methodia Rascal had been unlucky enough to take home? Eric had dismissed it as an attempt to scrounge another dollar. And probably it was, but no, the cube would surely have been long gone by then. Even so, it was an intriguing thought. The driver's hatch slid back. "Outside the city, sir. Clear road ahead," Willikins reported. "Thank you." Vimes stretched and looked across at Sybil. "Well, this is where we find out. Hang on to young Sam." "I'm sure Mustrom wouldn't do anything dangerous, Sam," said Sybil.
"I don't know about that," said Vimes, opening the door. "I'm sure he wouldn't mean to."
He swung himself out and hauled himself on the roof of the coach with a helping hand from Detritus. The coach was moving well. The sun was shining. On either side of the highway, the cabbage fields lent their gentle perfume to the air. Vimes settled down beside the butler.
"Okay," he said. "Everyone holding on to something? Good. Let them go."
Willikins cracked the whip. There was a mild jolt as the horses stretched, and Vimes felt the coach speed up. And that seemed to be it. He'd expected something a little more impressive. They were gradually going faster, yes, but that in itself didn't seem very magical.
"I reckon about 12 miles an hour now, sir," said Willikins. "That's pretty good. They're running well without—"
Something was happening to the harnesses. The copper discs were sparking.
"Look at the cabbages, sir," Detritus shouted.
On either side of the road, cabbages were bursting into flames and rocketing out of the ground, and still the horses went faster.
"It's about power," yelled Vimes above the wind. "We're running on cabbages, and up—"
He stopped. The rear two horses were rising gently in the air. As he stared, the lead pair rose too. He risked turning in his seat. The other coach was keeping up with them. He could clearly see Fred Colon's pink face staring ahead in rigid terror. When Vimes turned back to look ahead, all four horses were off the ground. And there was a fifth horse, larger than the other four and transparent. It was visible only because of the dust and the occasional glint of light off an invisible flank. It was, in fact, what you got if you took away a horse but left the movement of a horse, the speed of a horse, the spirit of a horse, that part of a horse which came alive in the rushing of the wind, the part of a horse that was, in fact, horse. There was hardly any sound now. Perhaps sound was unable to keep up.
"Sir," said Willikins quietly.
"Yes," said Vimes, his eyes streaming. "It took us less than a minute to go that last mile. I timed us between milestones, sir."
60 miles an hour? Don't be daft, man. A coach can't go that fast."
"Just as you say, sir."
A milestone flashed past. Out of the corner of his ear, Willikins heard Vimes counting under his breath, until before very long another stone fell away behind them.
"Wizards, eh?" said Vimes weakly, staring ahead again.
"Indeed, sir," said Willikins. "May I suggest that once we are through Quirm, we head straight across the grass country?"
"The roads up there are pretty bad, you know," said Vimes.
"So I believe, sir. However, that will not in fact matter," said the butler, not taking his eyes off the unrolling road ahead.
"Why not? If we try to go at speed over those rough—"
"I was referring obliquely, sir, to the fact that we are not precisely touching the ground any more."
Vimes, clinging with care to the rail, looked over the side. The wheels were turning idly. The road, just below them, was a blur. Ahead of them, the spirit of the horse galloped serenely onwards.
"There's plenty of coaching inns around Quirm," he said. "We could, stop for lunch?"
"A late breakfast, sir. Mail coach ahead, sir. Hold tight."
A tiny square block on the road ahead was getting bigger quite fast. Willikins twitched on the reins. Vimes had a momentary vision of rearing horses, and the mail coach was a dwindling dot, soon hidden by the smoke of flaming brassicas.
"Them milestones is going past real fast now," Detritus observed in a conversational tone of voice.
Behind him, Brick lay flat on the roof of the coach with his eyes shut tight, having never before been in a world where the sky went all the way to the ground. There were brass rails around the top of the coach, and he was leaving fingerprints in them.
"Could we try braking?" said Vimes. "Look out, hay cart!"
"That only stops the wheels spinning, sir," yelled Willikins as the cart went by with a whoom and fell back into the distance.
"Try pulling on the reins a little." "At this speed, sir?"
Vimes slid back the hatch behind him.
Sybil had young Sam on her knee and was pulling a woolly jumper over his head. "Is everything all right, dear?" he ventured. She looked up and smiled. "Lovely smooth ride, Sam. Aren't we going rather fast, though?" "Could you please sit with your back to the horses," said Sam, "and hold on tight to young Sam. It might be a bit bumpy." He watched her shift seats. Then he shut the hatch and yelled to Willikins, "Now!" Nothing seemed to happen. In Vimes's mind, the milestones were already going zip, zip, as they flashed past. Then the flying world slowed, while in the fields on either side hundreds of burning cabbages leapt toward the sky, trailing oily smoke. The horse of light and air disappeared, and the real horses dropped gently to the road, going from floating statues to beasts in full gallop without a stumble. He heard a brief scream as the rear coach tore past and swerved into a field full of cauliflowers, where eventually it squelched to a flatulent halt. And then there was stillness, except for the occasional thud of a falling cabbage. Detritus was comforting Brick, who'd not picked a good day to go cold turkey. It was turning out to be frozen rock. A skylark, safely above cabbage range, sang in the blue sky. Below, except for the whimpering of Brick, all was silent. Absent-mindedly, Vimes pulled a half-cooked leaf off his helmet and flicked it away. "Well, that was fun," he said, his voice a little distant. He got down carefully and opened the coach door. "Everyone all right in here?" he said. "Yes. Why are we stopped?" said Sybil. "We ran out of, well, we just ran out," said Vimes. "I'd better go and check that everyone else is all right." The milestone nearby proclaimed that it was but 2 miles to Quirm. Vimes fished out the gooseberry as a red-hot cabbage smacked into the road behind him. "Good morning," he said brightly to the surprised imp. "What is the time, please?" 9 minutes to 8, insert name here," said the imp. "So that would mean a speed slightly above 1 mile a minute," mused Vimes. "Very good." Moving like a sleepwalker, he walked into the field on the other side of the road and followed the trail of stricken, steaming greens until he reached the other coach. People were climbing out of it. "Everyone okay?" he said. "Breakfast today will be boiled cabbage, baked cabbage, fried cabbage." He stepped smartly aside as a steaming cauliflower hit the ground and exploded. "And cauliflower surprise. Where's Fred?" "Looking for somewhere to throw up," said Angua. "Good man. We'll take a minute or two to rest here, I think." With that, Sam Vimes walked back to the milestone, sat down next to it, put his arms around it, and held on tight until he felt better. You could catch up with the dwarfs long before they're near Coombe Valley. Good grief, at the speed we did earlier, you'd have to watch out in case you smashed into the back of them. Vimes's thoughts nagged at him as Willikins drove the coach, at a very sedate speed, out of Quirm and then, on a clear stretch of road, unleashed the hidden horsepower until they were bowling along at 40 miles every hour. That seemed quite fast enough. No one was hurt, after all. You could get to Coombe Valley by nightfall. Yes, but that was not the plan. Okay, he thought, but what was the plan, exactly? Well, it helped that Sybil knew more or less everybody, or at least everybody who was female, of a certain age, and who had been to the Quirm College for Young Ladies at the same time as Sybil. There appeared to be hundreds of them. They all seemed to have names like Bunny or Bubbles. They kept in touch meticulously. They'd all married influential or powerful men, they all hugged one another when they met, and went on about the good old days in Form 3B or whatever, and if they acted together, they could probably run the world. Or, it occurred to Vimes, might already be doing so. They were ladies who organise. Vimes did his best, but he could never keep track of them. A web of correspondence held them all together, and he marvelled at Sybil's ability to be concerned over the problems of a child whom she'd never met, of a woman she hadn't seen in 25 years. It was a female thing. So they would be staying in the town near the foot of the valley, with a lady currently known only as Bunty, whose husband was the local magistrate. According to Sybil, he had his own police force. Vimes translated this, in the privacy of his head, as "he's got his own gang of thuggish, toothless, evil-smelling thief-takers," since that was what you generally got in these little towns. Still, they might be useful. Beyond that, there was no plan. He intended to find the dwarfs and capture and drag as many as possible back to Ankh-Morpork, but that was an intention, not a plan. It was a firm intention, though. 5 people had been murdered. You couldn't just turn your back on that. He'd drag 'em back and lock them up and throw everything at them and see what stuck. He doubted it they had many friends now. Of course, it'd get political, it always did, but at least people would know that he'd done all he could,
and it was the best he could do. With any luck, it would stop anyone else getting funny ideas. And then there was the damn secret. But it occurred to him that if he did find it, and it simply was proof that the dwarfs ambushed the trolls, or the trolls ambushed the dwarfs, or they both ambushed each other at the same time, well, he might as well drop it down a hole. It wouldn't change anything, and it was unlikely to be a pot of gold. People didn't take a lot of money onto battlefields because there wasn't very much to spend it on. Anyway, it had been a good start. They'd clawed some time, hadn't they? They could keep up a cracking pace and change horses at every staging inn, couldn't they? Why was he trying to persuade himself? It made sense to slow down. It was dangerous to go fast. "If we keep up this pace, we might get there the day after tomorrow, right?" he said to Willikins as they rattled on between stands.